Save big money in your next painting project now at Menards. From your kitchen and bath to doors and trim and even your ceilings, Dutch Boy has the perfect finish for your painting projects. Dutch Boy's DuraFighter is a tough paint and primer that provides great scrub resistance and durability. Save big on Dutch Boy paints. Plus, view our weekly flyer on Menards.com and get your painting project started today. Save big money
at Menards. This is Hidden Killers Half Year in Review. A look back at some of the most compelling cases of 2026 so far. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
Let's continue our conversation. Prosecutors allege Celeste walked into David Burke's Hollywood Hills home on April 23rd, 2025, and was never heard from again. Her dismembered remains turned up months later in his Tesla. In between, Burke reportedly made middle of the night trip to a remote spot in Santa Barbara, performed at Coachella, you know, like you do after someone's missing or dead in your presence, released a debut album, or was about to, and launched a world tour, including a show in Minneapolis the same night her body was found in Los Angeles. The charges are brutal, but the thing that eats at people is the silence, the months of normal, the people who knew him and said nothing, and the question nobody can shake: how? And let's get into this. He was on stage in Minneapolis the night her body was found in the trunk in LA. Months of shows, smiling, performing his love songs. I think that's the interesting thing. We were just talking in our last segment about this way of thinking, about the compartmentalization that people of this age seem to have, because it's just the atmosphere of which they grow up in, especially if it's mainly online, the lack of depth. When also you have the lack of depth, I think you also seem to lack the ability to understand the weight of the events that are going on around you. And I think that's what might be what we're seeing in this case as well, where he's on stage in Minneapolis, they're finding a body in his frunk, and it's just another normal Tuesday for him. I mean, it seems that there's a level of numbness, if you will, to reality that so many young narcissists seem to have, where it's just body in your trunk is about as important to know that as the McRib is back at McDonald's. It's like it's the same level of weight, and it obviously should not be. But if you don't naturally have the ability to experience that weight, to feel the weight of those being two very different things in life, how do you develop that? I mean, that really is the recipe for a psychopath if you're not able to differentiate between something like that.
Yes. 100%. Yeah. And it also reminded me of the amount of compartmentalization that we see with serial killers who can, you know, do something absolutely horrendous and then go to church the next day. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like, how does a person compartmentalize like that? And yes, it's very concerning that this person can do that. I mean, just the dismemberment of a body, you know, that I always, just a little game I play in my mind when I look at criminals. It's like, can I ever imagine myself doing this, right? Can I even wrap my head around it? And I have always thought, could I kill another human being? Certainly not something I think about or fantasize about. But I think, yes, if somebody were breaking in my house, someone threatening my children, could I do something to end their life? I think I could. But would it ever occur to me to dismember their body? Ever?
Yeah.
Is that something I can even wrap my head around, somebody who would be okay with that, whether he did it himself or had someone else do it? You're dealing with somebody with some very, very concerning personality traits,
you know,
there.
And these are very extremely really salient points to bring up, because even so, here I am, former Marine and FBI. The amount of training you go through to take someone else's life potentially is pretty robust. Going through deadly force policies, going through rules of engagement of war. And every single time you're faced with these things, you're always someone with great deep empathy, because if you're in a life of service, which is what I've been in my entire life, is You're serving and protecting, which might mean you have to do horrendous things to other human beings. Even as they're horrendous human beings, the thought and the weight of even having to do that potentially weighs on you. The counseling that you go through afterwards. I mean, I'm getting a dry mouth just thinking about it. I mean, just the tremendous impact of you as an individual, because you actually have empathy. You don't have an ability to compartmentalize it because you are a regular human being serving other human beings is tremendous. And so being able to do these things so compartmentalized like he did, or anyone in that circle did, whoever did this, it's absolutely insane to think that this is normal human behavior, because it's not even close. And the thing, you know, we're so stuck on cults right now. It is so cult-like, you know, with the Duggars, the same kind of compartmentalization that you can completely abuse and have in your close society and system, this abuse of another human being, underage human being, and being able to try to move on from life and diminishing it and rationalizing it. It's just so, it rings so similarly to all these other horrendous crimes. And the last thing I want to say on this is, in the music industry, there are some really, I mean, there's some great people, and there's horrendous people as well. And I remember years ago, I'm a country music fan, and I'll never forget, I was so impacted by Sugarland, Jennifer Nettles. Years ago, I remember when their stage collapsed and some of their fans got injured, right? That's the last time we saw Jennifer Nettles on Sugarland for a very, very long time. It was crushing to them, the impact of even just that on their fans. That's what empathy is. Now, granted, there might have been a lot of things in there and lawsuits and all that, but I don't know. But just the impact, you saw the emotional impact of even just them performing and the injury to fans did to them personally. And here you're seeing the same thing play out with completely back-asswards results.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
100%. I remember that. I was working in country radio at the time.
Wasn't that impactful?
Yeah, I mean,
you saw how crushed he was.
Yeah, I remember that. That was a while back, but yeah, I do remember that. What I'm trying to think about here with David and this idea, they're bringing up in the charging docs that Burke made a late night drive to a remote area of Santa Barbara in the spring of 2025. Of course, like we've been saying, the charges include mutilation of the remains. We don't know if that drive had something to do with it. If it did, if it didn't, it's really kind of besides the point. I don't know what's more disturbing. The fact that it appears her remains were cut up out of convenience to fit into a frunk, or out of contempt because she was going to expose him. I don't know what's more disturbing here to think of how he was looking at this, allegedly, you know, if he's the one who did it. This is, well, it's, we got to fit it in here, so it's basically human Tetris, you know, or it's, I hate you, you're going to expose me, and I'm, you know, I guess this is my saw motion, I guess. I'm just trying to, like, think of, like, I don't know, whatever somebody's doing with a saw. Maybe they're using a saw. I don't know. But that's, or maybe it's a combination of both that's going on here. But the fact that it's just such an easy lever to pull, I guess, is the most disturbing part of it, no matter what the reasoning is behind it.
Yeah, I think it can go either way. There are probably cases where it's just a matter of convenience, but still, you'd have to be pretty psychopathic to even think that way.
Yeah.
But there are certainly times when it's motivated more by rage, and the person actually gets pleasure from mutilating the body, which is also something you see with sadistic people who are serial killers. They get pleasure from the mutilation, which is, yeah, really disturbing.
That just, like, doesn't that just go against, like, all everything of humanity? I mean, would that same person find, like, the smell of a rotting flesh to be like, oh, fresh baked cookies? I mean, the rest of us are throwing up, you know, the second we get a whiff of something like that. They're like, ah, this is great. I mean, it seems to go so much against humanity in general.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, I'm so with you on this, Tony, because, I mean, think about this. Again, what Siobhan said is I do the same thing, and that you try to place yourself in that person's shoes, and that's how we have these deep empathies, so you can start hopefully predicting behavior to prevent horrendous things like this. And so think about this. So here they are. So let's say, let's for argument's sake, say it's an accidental death. It wasn't done out of rage. You know, so we're going to say this was an accidental death and that they had a panic escalation and this was their decision-making process. How stupid is that, right? But so think about this. If you are an empathetic human being that actually gave a rat's ass about anyone else other than yourself, and you're faced with this kind of situation, and your initial impulse is to, oh my God, a panic escalation, and you're thinking, not thinking, you say, I got to hide the body, got to get rid of the body, and you try to stuff her into a frunk of a Tesla, and we know Jennifer Coffendeffer tried this, and she could see you can't fit, you got to do something to it. Here's the first thought you have, is not how to make the body fit. The first impression you have, if you actually have reason, oh, this whole thing doesn't sound reasonable anyway, but is, I got to find another way mm-hmm. instead of cutting up the body. Because if you, I mean, just that just makes no sense to do that whatsoever, unless, to Siobhan's point, is you are actually pure psychopathic, that you have zero empathy, that this is just a tool, a screwdriver in your life that you said, I no longer have use for it, we got to get rid of it.
Yeah, I mean, that's the only way you can, I think, function that way, is if you're looking at that, you know, you're looking at Celeste's body as nothing more than something of value, like a lint roller. It's like, mm-hmm. well, I got to fit this somewhere. Well, if I take it apart, you know, then I can do that. It's a lint roller. It doesn't have feelings. I have no empathy for it. If I have to dismantle it to fit it into a bag or something, I can do it. It's not going to hurt me. But if you're having that same sort of feeling about a human being, that's...
And Siobhan, so how much time would it take for the prefrontal lobe and the emotional hijacking to flood back out again? In other words, wouldn't there be enough time when you're actually thinking about how I got to now dismember this body to make it fit the frunk, where you actually, by the time you actually start getting the tools arranged and everything, if it wasn't premeditated, to say, oh, dude, that's a bad idea. See what I mean? So in other words... If it was a panic escalation to think I should do this, by the time you actually got to the point of doing it, if you weren't actually a true nutter, you'd say, oh, that's not a really good idea.
That's not a good idea. It wouldn't be the automatic response unless you had your saw ready, right? It's like, you know, you've done this before, so you've got the tools and you know how to do it. Yeah, he had to ponder this a bit, and obviously... You know, is this an IQ test for, you know?
They thought this was a good idea.
Yeah, and then to just put the body in the, is it thrunk that we're calling it?
Thrunk.
Okay. Put it in the frunk and then just move the car around the town. I mean, I can't wrap my head around that either. While you're going out and doing musical performances and know that your Tesla registered to you is just parked with a body in it and changing locations every so often. Yeah, this is not a thinking person.
It's like intelligent in so many ways over here, but then over here in functional ways, non-existent.
Non-existent
at all. Yeah. Let's talk about his parents a little bit. And I saw in the comments too, somebody said, hey, we were talking about her parents. Let's talk about his. Let's. Burke's parents went to court in Texas trying to block their own subpoenas. Siobhan, I mean, you've sat across from families of people accused of the worst things imaginable. When a family fights that hard to not answer questions, is that love? Is that denial? Is that something else? What do you think is going? Is it self-preservation of we're not going to get ourselves deeper into this than we already are? I mean, what the hell is going on when you're going to whatever lengths possible to not have to be accountable in any way, shape, or form when someone's life has been stolen from them and your son is the one that they're looking at?
I think all of the above from what you said, their version of love very likely is more my perfect child can't have done anything wrong. Mm-hmm. And if he did, they justify it. And they're going to do everything they can to try to, you know, keep the case from progressing and get in the way of it. But that's also the kind of parenting that produces narcissists, you know, that I will do anything to protect my kid. Which I another thing I can't wrap my head around, you know.
Yeah. Do you think I know that reports already comes from a pretty religious family and religious background? Do you think any of that played into it?
That's a really interesting factor, because I would love to know what religion looked like for them, as we've talked so much about all the different ways religion can manifest. And there are certain forms of religion, you know, I think of the prosperity gospel people, which is very much focused on, you know, getting all those blessings and earning all that money and you're special, you know. So there are narcissistic manifestations of religion. And it, certainly, I would guess they were not Southern Baptists, you know, they were not into the service, you know, that you are here to serve and you're not special and you're a sinner and own that. My guess, it would be a very different flavor of religion. Or again, do they just really compartmentalize well?
Yeah, and what's their interpretation of what they're taken into? You know,
exactly.
I mean, as we learn more and more, as we cover so many cases of different religiosity, you have like the religion, and then you got the version of it that's being pitched within the home itself, and sometimes that's even far worse or more bizarre or whatever than the actual one. So, I mean, that's a question only they would know on the inside, but it certainly is an interesting angle of the recipe that made David Anthony Burke. Your questions in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We are going to continue to try and get through them. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you're getting podcasts. You don't miss any of it. Siobhan's latest book, Nightbird, available wherever you get books. Highly recommend. Go and check this out, especially her stories of escaping extreme religiosity and surviving it and thriving and helping so many people along the way. This is
I'm actually listening to it for a second time.
You are.
I am. There's a lot in there. I mean, there's a lot in there. And there's because of Siobhan's upbringing, her background, you know, I think in the world of us in true crime covering cults and cult mentalities and everything, Siobhan's insights are really powerful in that book. It's literally, I'm an Audible guy and listen to Siobhan go through this twice, I'm capturing more, even more a second time. So again, thanks you, Siobhan, for doing that.
Definitely. Go and check that out.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
We're learning so much more every day about the case against David and the death of Celeste Rivas Hernandez. David Anthony Burke is his full legal name. He's the only person charged in the death of Celeste Rivas Hernandez, but prosecutors have reportedly said he didn't act alone in disposing of her remains. And everyone from his manager to his best friend or former best friend to his parents have been pulled before a grand jury or fought to stay out of one. So why is Burke sitting in a cell while the people around him are walking free? Let's talk about that. Let's talk about the circle. Let's also talk about some of the new developments that have come out in this case. Eric Faddis, defense attorney, former felony prosecutor, is here with us to help break all of this down, along with Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. It's bad. And I guess the first things we heard from the private investigator that was at the house that said there's some very disturbing, dark things going on here. Turns out he was pretty right. Let's start, though, Eric, with the fact that David Anthony Burke allegedly did not act alone in the disposal of Celeste remains. At least that's somewhat of the belief of the state. But he's the only one that is named in the felony complaint. He's the one that is behind bars. What does that say to you about what's going on here behind the scenes, that there's only been one arrest so far after nearly half a year of investigation into this?
Well, look, Tony, I think the dismemberment of a human body often requires multiple people. It often requires assistance and help and supplies and planning and things like that. Especially when we're talking about David, he was, I think, in his early 20s when they're alleging he did this. Mm-hmm. I would be very surprised if he was the only person who knew about this and the only person who had any involvement. But at this juncture, he is the only named defendant.
Yeah, that's kind of strange, Eric, isn't it? Only because we know there's more, potentially more. And would you theorize that it's potentially because people have flipped, people are cooperating, or is it just because they haven't gotten around to those charges yet, do you think?
There are a number of potential explanations. It certainly could be that some of the folks who may have been involved are now government witnesses. They're now cooperating with the government. There have been posts from at least one of his friends that seemed to suggest that he was no longer aligned with David. Does that mean that he's no longer aligned legally, such that he's a witness against David? Would not be surprised about that. Also, perhaps that law enforcement, wanted to drop this bombshell of these homicide charges and then see what the people around David do. Do they come to law enforcement? Do they say, hey, before I'm the next person named on such a complaint, I got some stuff to tell you. That could be too.
Yeah, I agree. And before you go, Tony, I got to apologize because we covered this case quite a few times already. And I got to do it my own retraction here. I was giving him some plausible deniability and grace, saying accidental potential death. But after what just came out yesterday, no way. Whoever did this, again, innocent until proven guilty. This was extremely intentional from what we just learned from the autopsy.
I mean, I think we all did. It's one of those things where it was very plausible that this was young and dumb. And we'll get to that in just a little bit. But it certainly felt like this is a cover up. Something bad happened and they made really, really horrible choices after the fact. Turns out it looks like it's all of the above and then some, and far worse.
And so one more follow-up to that, Eric. So is it, given the grievousness and the extreme of this case, of the type of death and post-mortem and what they did, is there any chance that if someone is cooperating and they actually were knowledgeable of it or involved in any way, that they would get a pass? Or are they going to be maybe just mitigating factors that they cooperated? What typically happens in these cases?
Yeah, it really depends on the degree of cooperation, the duration of cooperation, the commitments the person has made to cooperate. Sometimes that means complete immunity, which is that individual could not be charged, could not be convicted and receive a sentence. Sometimes it's partial immunity. Sometimes it's essentially like a plea deal on the side. Hey, if you cooperate to all of this, we'll let you plead to a low-level felony or misdemeanor and you might get probation. So really a number of options for law enforcement to consider when they're trying to recruit witnesses to assist.
Roger, thank you.
Do the witnesses who may be assisting here, Neil Langston is one of them that has made the statement. He was in a lot of photos with David. He was the one that was taken from Montana to California by force. He was arrested and taken. He's released a statement through his attorney saying he's fully cooperated with law enforcement and will continue to assist the prosecution as needed. When we're talking about maybe a deal of some sort here, are those sort of deals always in place prior to the trial, prior to whatever happens here in whatever case we see here against David, even his own sentencing? Does Neo know what the road, what lies on the road ahead of him prior to David possibly being found guilty here? Or could that be something of, okay, you're going to cooperate, we're not going to charge you right now, but if you'd like to not be charged, then you need to keep cooperating. But there's still no guarantee on the table that at some point we might charge you too. Is it just keep going down the road and hope for the best? Or are these sort of agreements set in stone prior to an actual trial?
Sometimes you have a concrete plea bargain for a cooperating witness from the outset, but really more often, Tony, it's law enforcement kind of saying, and they do this with informants in gang cases and drug cases, things like that. And they say, hey, you keep cooperating, you keep doing your thing, you keep feeding us information and evidence. And then at the end, we'll kind of assess how good you did and how much help your cooperation was. And at that juncture, we'll sort of decide what we're going to do with you. There is not something set in stone where it's like, hey, if you tell us X, Y, and Z, and then you testify, you for sure get a misdemeanor. It's usually more kind of up in the air, and law enforcement use that as leverage to kind of hold over these folks' head to say, hey, make sure you're still cooperating or else this could get bad for you really quickly.
Does it help or hurt the prosecution with the fact that it appears that many of the witnesses who some may speculate, may have been involved. Possibly, we don't know. Again, not charged with anything, but it's the same attorney, Robert Morgengroth, or Morgengroth, I can never say his name right, is representing several people here. Does that help or hurt the state's case when you have one attorney representing several people that may or may not be involved?
I think there are a number of issues that can arise with that, Tony. You know, and we may be getting to this later, but conflicts. An attorney cannot have a conflict in their representation, whereby, you know, they're putting one client's interests above another client's interests. And so I think that it complicates things a little bit, and it provides a potential ground for critique of the prosecution's entire case, where defense might say, hey, look, there is some ethically dubious stuff going on in the representation of these witnesses. So that's just another reason why you can't believe them.
What kind of challenges do you think the prosecution faces in this? I mean, a lot of things seem really overwhelming, that there's a lot of, I mean, you got one car, one body, only a very few number of people with access. The Tesla's got a lot of data, you know, that supposedly it collects, you know, so but it's, as always, there's no, you know, easy case. There's no lock solid case. But so what kind of holes or challenge do you think the prosecution is going to have on this?
You know, Robin, at first blush, there are certainly some very strong aspects of the prosecution's case, but there are some questions and there are some potential holes. You know, one is the day and time of death. Usually an autopsy can't do that if they get the body within days. Here, the body was severely decomposed and certainly they could make no such conclusion. However, the charges do list a date of death, which I think is 1 or 2 days after Celeste officially went missing. But where did this death happen? Who was present? What were the specific circumstances under which it happened? These are questions that the autopsy might not answer fully. And so, although we have what appears to be a grisly murder, who did that and where did it happen and when did it happen? These are questions a jury's going to have, and I don't have answers to these based on what's been publicly disclosed.
Yeah, and my question on that too, and I apologize, but I guarantee you've seen more of this than I have, hopefully, maybe, on the autopsy side, because this is such a long period of time in between the murder or her death and the being able to do the autopsy because of being in that frunk of that car and in such a state of decomposition. I know they always challenge autopsies, but do you think the autopsy itself is going to be able to be contested just because of that length of time and the ability to do it? Or is an autopsy an autopsy an autopsy?
No, Robin, I think that it's probably likely that defense is going to hire their own forensic pathologist. They might even request to do their own autopsy. And that autopsy, or at least the report from the forensic pathologist from defense, might be in stark contrast to some of the things that are contained in the government's autopsy. So, you know, it's I think it's sort of common knowledge to look at it and say, oh, there's a medical examiner. They did an autopsy. This must be sacrosanct. But once you get into that sort of gauntlet of the courtroom process, that's not always the case.
I'm going to do one more highly conjecture question on this one. I apologize.
You're fine.
So, given that length of time and the state of the body, they're saying that the autopsy revealed penetrating wounds. Have you seen any other cases that might be similar where defense could say what that penetrating wound was other than a stab wound, other than something like that? In other words, what would they potentially throw to counter that other than just it was bad forensics and doing the autopsy?
Potentially, Robin, you know, it reminds me a little bit in a sense of the Barry Morphew case, where Suzanne Morphew, the victim, her body wasn't found until I think at least a year after they believed the death occurred. And there were certain injuries and findings of the government's autopsy. And then the defense experts look at it and they say, hey, this could have been some of what you're describing in terms of the findings on this body. This could have been from an animal. This could have been from the elements, even in that case, Suzanne's body was outside. So it just goes to show that there are absolutely other potential medical theories that I think the defense are going to come up with that could explain what was observed on Celeste's body.
All right. Thank you. As, again, I'm just playing my devil's advocate of what they're going to do because I listen to too much Bob Mata sometimes.
Let's talk about his family a little bit. His parents, siblings, Dwoad, Colleen, Caleb, they fought the grand jury subpoena in Texas, arguing that they received redacted files and couldn't even see why they were considered material witnesses. A Texas appeal court to order them to comply if they ultimately testified. What kind of liability do they face, especially if they knew? I'm not saying that they did, but if they had knowledge, however that may have come about, whether it was David saying, yep, I did this, but if they had that sort of knowledge over all this period of time and didn't come forward, you don't have like the spousal argument here at all. Yeah. What kind of liability do they face, or of any, if they had knowledge of what their son or their sibling David is accused of doing?
Sure, Tony. So there is no familial privilege under criminal law. You know, there's a spousal privilege where, as a general rule, your spouse can't testify against you, but there are exceptions. At any rate, the family enjoys no such privilege. Now, on the other hand, just having knowledge of a really horrible thing in and of itself is probably not criminal. And you probably do not have an affirmative duty to report any of that and like turn in your son for doing something terrible. But if there is something beyond knowledge, even kind of a scintilla of material assistance, material aid, concealment, things like that. If these folks were questioned and they gave information that was inaccurate because they were trying to protect David from apprehension or something, that's when we start to wade into the realm of potential criminal liability, possible civil liability in terms of like a wrongful death case or something along those lines.
What about moving of assets?
Good one.
Yeah. Because
that appears to have might have happened through some of the reporting of his assets being moved, being protected underneath the family and out of his control because of facing the very real charges that he now faces.
Yeah, that's a great question, Tony. I think, you could not make any sort of fraudulent transfers that were based on false pretenses. You could not transfer any kind of assets in furtherance of a crime, but is protecting assets the same as furthering a crime? Probably not.
Yeah.
I'm not sure there's a great legal mechanism to prevent folks from doing that. Like if there's a divorce case, one spouse cannot transfer a bunch of assets to protect them from the other claimant getting them. But I'm not aware of any such corollary in criminal law or in the types of civil laws that could be implicated here.
It's crazy because we're seeing so many parents these days in all these cases, whether it's a school shooting or in this case or going on cruise ships, which we're going to cover. You know, parents' involvement seems to be at a much higher level than we've ever really taken a look at it before. So the culpability and the legal side of it isn't really, I think, catching up sometimes. And kind of going back to that, with the parents potentially being witting or knowledgeable and not being necessarily legally culpable, how does that, again, I'm the behavior guy, not the legal guy. How does that mesh with, say, remember, I just know that if a therapist or a doctor becomes aware of horrendous things happening from that one of their patients is doing, that they confess to them there's something, or there's bruises on bodies, that they have a duty to report that to law enforcement, correct? And if that's true, then how come parents don't have that same obligation, or anyone in a family has that same obligation if they become aware of illegal acts, especially at this level? How come there isn't a compulsion to report it, or at least legally culpable if they don't?
It's a fair question, Robin. You know, we have laws for mandatory reporters. Like you said, oftentimes those are therapists. They can be in the education context, teachers, things like that. Right. And I think the idea is that, hey, they come into contact with folks, you know, who could be victims, who could be vulnerable all the time. And so this is sort of a protective mechanism. There is no such mandatory reporting requirement for families. And I don't know if that's like a policy decision that's rested upon, you know, hey, we don't want families breaking their own families up all the time because they suspect something might have gone wrong. On the balance, it might be better for law enforcement to just do their thing independent of the families without an affirmative obligation for the families to sort of go in and rat out their family member. But very fair question.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Your thoughts in the comments section on Substack and YouTube. If you're not already there, please give us your thoughts. We'll try and get to them as we continue the conversation here about David.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Normally in these ads, you'd expect someone like me to ask you to buy something. But I want to ask you to do something different. I'm Dave Farenthold, and I'm a reporter for the New York Times. I'm an investigative reporter, which means that I follow the money, inside of government and outside of government. The point of my job is to find things people are trying to hide. It involves talking to lots of people. It involves looking through lots and lots of documents. And if there weren't folks like me to go beyond the surface to understand who is really shaping what the government does, the public would be left in the dark about what the government's doing with your tax money, what the government's doing to you through regulations and spending. If you're like me and you think this kind of journalism is important, seek out a news source that does firsthand, fact-based reporting. If that's the New York Times, thank you. If that's your local paper, that's great too, because where you get your information matters.
Out at McDonald's, te puedes llevar un $5 McChicken meal deal o un $6 McDouble meal deal. Así hay algo para todos. Llévate más por tu dinero con tu meal deal. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. Solo por tiempo limitado. Precios y participación pueden variar. Precios con entrega pueden ser más altos.